moral voices, people of goodwill, have to stand up and speak truth to power. It's our democracy that we have to reclaim in a moment like this.
We want to thank you both for being with us, especially on this day, Juneteenth. That's right, June 19th in 1865 was the day that African-Americans in Texas learned 2 years after the Emancipation Proclamation that the slaves had been freed. That does it for our broadcast. Reverend Dr. Raphael Warnock, Colin Goddard, thanks for joining us. I'll be speaking in Custer, Wisconsin, Saturday at 1 o'clock. Democracy Now! Is hiring a senior news producer and engagement editor. Find out all the details at democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Thanks for joining us.
This is WHFR Dearborn, and now it's time for our public affairs show, and we call it the new WHFR Journal. Hello and welcome to another edition of the new WHFR Journal, local news and alternative views for Dearborn and the surrounding area. My name is Jay Koronek, happy to be with you today, along with our co-host here at WHFR, the WHFR News Director himself, John Conroy. Welcome, John.
Oh, thank you, Jay. Good to be here.
And we're going to start right off. A lot of great things we're going to be talking about on today's show. A lot of things really happening now very quickly around Dearborn this summer. But first off, we have a live person, other than John and myself, in the studio for an interview. I've known her a long time. We won't say how long. But she was a colleague of mine when I was in the English division at Henry Ford College. And although I think at the time I was in the English division, I was primarily just starting to teach telecommunication area. But Dr. Nancy Nelson, welcome to the new WHFR Journal.
Hi, thanks for having me. And it's really great to continue this connection with the college and with you, Jay.
Right. She retired from full-time, as many people have done, like myself, and we just can't keep them away. I'll tell you, it's something special going on here. Right. We don't have to go through the details, but and Nancy, you've had, I should say Dr. Nelson, but I've known you.
I'll say, just so Nancy.
We're dropping the formality here, folks. That's the nature of the
Absolutely.
Show. Just get to the core
Mr.
of things.
Koronek.
Thanks. Whoops. The areas that you've taught, the classes you've taught here, pretty wide range, mm-hmm. but certainly some advanced literature
Absolutely.
Classes. You were working with the honors program for a while,
I did.
Too.
I taught honors English, both sections, did a colloquium. I won't say how long ago either.
Wow.
Women's Lit, British literature, the novel,
mm-hmm.
pretty
yeah.
much everything yeah. that we had. Yeah.
Right. And what you have done now is really great. I know that you've had academic publications before. One about a poet, I know, that you did, but you had several of those published. And, of course, you've taught elsewhere than here, especially most recently in Prescott, Arizona.
That's correct.
And in that location, and I won't get the Indian name right for the college, but you were an associate or an assistant director of their creative writing program
Correct.
There, too.
Hacienda, Indian name.
There you go, Hacienda. Do you know the meaning of that? Does it have a meaning?
I believe it means where the water breaks on the rocks, as in turmoil and creativity.
Ooh,
that idea. Yeah,
that's exciting.
Really,
that's a good choice
idea.
For a college name. And any of those natives still around?
There's actually a reservation right there.
Oh, well, that's good. That's
so,
at least there's
there. Mm-hmm.
There's some representation.
Their presence is definitely there.
We've got to keep those cultures going somehow.
Absolutely.
Well, the whole exciting thing, at least for me, is that you have, and maybe you've written some memoirs before, perhaps.
Not book length, only
and
small
this is,
pieces.
This is her new book, right. folks, that's going to be available for sale. She has an appearance at First Universalist Universal Church, that's Casson Forest in the Wayne State University area, tomorrow at 11 in the morning.
Actually, Sunday.
I'm sorry,
no
Sunday.
Problem.
Yeah, Sunday at 11 in the morning. So they could do a Unitarian church service there, either before or after.
Actually, so. I am the service.
Oh, you are the service.
Yes, and the music and everything will be
I love those Unitarians. You know.
That's the way we do it.
That's right. It's all education and community. And
spirituality too, right. You know, it's well, wonderful.
Okay, first of all, as a literature professor, you can give a short lecture here. What is memoir writing? What is a memoir? People are probably familiar with biographies and autobiographies. How does that all fit together?
I love this question. Thank you. And I'll give you my perspective on it since I've been dabbling for a long time and dabbling more seriously with this book. We used to hear about the memoirs of presidents, say, or Winston Churchill. This is different. That was pretty autobiographical. I mean, this is what I did during this war or whatever. Mm-hmm. Memoir has emerged as a strong genre in the last 20 years in this country. One of my writer friends says that it's because it's such a democratic process. Anybody's story is of value, and the issue is to put a voice to that. As far as I think autobiographical writing or an autobiography is, I was born here and went here and here. But it's an umbrella for many other genres, one of which is memoir, which is a book which follows a thread or theme. You mentioned before we started that there were three generations in my book. Mm-hmm. And basically, it is about my trying to figure out why my maternal grandmother was never spoken of. She died having my mother, and my mother had all these years of burden, and there was this whispering in family. And so I went about over 100 years later to try to find out. So mm-hmm. that was my thread. But I could write other memoirs about various other themes.
Right. Memoir typically is writing about yourself, but in this case it's your family and your recollection mm-hmm. of the relationships. Did you actually know your maternal grandmother?
No, and my mother didn't know her own mother either.
Oh wow.
Like it's 1 hour after she was born, so there's wow. always this background of hushed silence. And actually a person is in the memoir because, at least for me, the most gripping thing about it is that we have to discover something about ourselves while we were doing mm-hmm. this, and that definitely happened to me.
So. Like autobiographies, I understand memoirs usually are written in first person.
Yes.
And you do too
yeah.
here.
And yes. you experience something okay. either in researching or interaction with people.
Okay. So. All right. So she seemed like, obviously relatively close. I mean, your mother's mother, relatively mm-hmm. close to you, but without knowing what was going on there, you wonder if it was, I know that actually in my relatives, great-great-grandfather or great-uncle or someone, we had a picture of him, but everyone said we never talk about him. Somehow a quote-unquote black sheep in the family. But it doesn't have to be a bad person. It can just be some misunderstanding or a single moment where mm-hmm. a decision was made that wasn't respected somehow, and you don't have to give away the secret here. Let me just say that your book title is Searching for Nanny B, and Three Generations of Southern Women, and we're talking to Dr. Nancy Nelson here from the English Department at Henry Ford College. Your website, if people want more information, is Nancy Owen Nelson, and I think they know that Nelson is S-O-N, right?
Mm-hmm.
.com. Okay, so more you can get more information that way, of course, too. But so how long did it take you to pull together this information, and where did you find it? Did you have to use some internet sources?
Yes, actually.
Ancestry.com or every
yes.
there other places than that?
I started there, and okay. It's in the book, actually. I started in November of 2011, of all things, because I remember when I bought the membership. And for some reason, I thought, you know, my mom's been gone for 10 years. I think I want to find out where her mother's buried. So I started, and I began. It's very, I guess you would say, addictive. After you get in, you start finding out all these things, and you see where people lived. You can pull up census. And one of the things that I do mention early in the book is that the state of Alabama had no mention of burial, no mention of obituary. Nothing. All our birth certificates back then, because she was born in 1879. All they had, and it took me a lot of searching, was a grave I finally found.
Wow.
And the marriage certificate of my grandparents, which they were married just under 1 year. So she had my mother and died right there. So
And there weren't too many other people alive you could ask. Was that possible? No, you had to go through just documents and records.
I found somebody.
You found somebody. Okay,
third cousin. Oh, I don't know. I don't think I have 3 hours to explain. But
oh no.
But this was the great granddaughter. The granddaughter of the granddaughter of one of my grandmother's sisters, who had not met my grandmother but had heard stories and knew my mother and also knew my step grandmother. And had information about why there was such a silence.
I see.
So I was really, and then she passed just months later. I was so grateful I caught her. So bless Helen.
How accurate is some of this information? I mean, we're always told that Wikipedia is not necessarily all that accurate as a general sort of encyclopedia on the internet. Did you have to cross-check some references on different sources?
I think we can rely, we know that Ancestry.com and Family Finders are based on documents, and then people like myself go in and make connections. Sometimes they are inaccurate, so you have to know that you're not going to get a solid, fast answer. But I did know, I could tell that these people, a couple of generations back, were related because of where they lived. And my sister is a few years older than I knew some names, so that was helpful. Mm-hmm. I think, and as far as Wikipedia, I think if it's got a documented reference, it's fine. You know, just go with that.
Well, would some of our listeners, would this be unbelievably difficult a task, or I mean, would you recommend that?
Oh.
I mean, a lot of people who, a majority of people in Dearborn over the age of 50, mm-hmm. maybe over the age of 60 now, because that number is ever increasing here. And memoir writing is actually taught in some mm-hmm. places, usually as a enrichment activity, not necessarily. I'm sure if it was taught in a four-year school that had a literary program,
right.
that they could go into the history of it. And my research on Wikipedia showed that there was even some memoir writing that goes back to the early Greeks and Romans mm-hmm. and so on too. Now, just there are some examples all the
right.
way throughout history of what fits here. But could it be redemptive? Satisfying, fulfilling to do this? I mean, an autobiography, since G would have to be so long, seems really too much
mm-hmm.
to try.
Right. Yes.
So you think it's accessible
Absolutely.
For many people?
I mean, if anyone is pretty comfortable with the internet, mm-hmm. that's a really good source and is willing to take some leaps of faith to try to find, say, graves. There's a findagrave.com site, for example.
But for memoirs, you're looking for individual stories, really, or
right.
the theme of or the thread of a story.
But you're also, and this is what's fascinating, you're also looking at how you yourself respond to that story. Mm. So, for example, mm-hmm. if you got your uncle, if you've sort of dug that up, and you found out that whatever he did was not so horrible, you might say, why did my family do this? And you mm-hmm. were looking at yourself. I'm not saying you have to do that, but
right.
of course, I'm all on to people doing that because I think it's very fulfilling. It can also be challenging because you might find out, one might find out some things about him or herself that have not been confronted before, and my book does contain that.
So in a memoir, there's mm-hmm. that individual reflection
That's
upon
right.
what you've discovered,
mm-hmm.
and your thoughts can be there, whereas a biography is usually a little more academic.
Mm-hmm.
You're not doing
right.
it first person. You're trying to
right.
like hover around the story in the past.
Right.
And
Most memoirists have, many of them have wept as they did parts of it, or
oh,
found
goodness.
Out things. I mean, it's really pretty. It can be intense. Mm-hmm. You don't have to be that intense, but you know, it's
sometimes wonderful. Biographers they actually dabble in what it seems to me is dramatization,
mm-hmm.
A little
mm-hmm.
bit. That they have, you know, they talk about events, but then they actually start giving dialogue, which they couldn't possibly have heard, or maybe they had some reference in general, but then they provide the dialogue. And so that seems to be. Moving, you know, taking a device from fiction in, but it's not necessarily inappropriate if you really know your subject well and you're pretty sure you know the personalities involved. What about memoir writing? Does that happen at all?
Thank you. Yes, in fact, another name or label for this genre or the umbrella is creative nonfiction, which means mm-hmm. that memoir can and should maybe read like a novel. That we want to engage a reader so that the story is not just my story, but I'm engaging you, you know, in the drama of it, for example. And as far as conversations, students, women, or people who I've taught at the Springfield Arts organization say, I don't remember what was said. And I say, try to imagine what is likely. And you can say, I imagine them speaking this way. Mm-hmm. That's fair, as long as you're honest with your reader, you know.
Right. So, I see a lot of courses in memoir writing, well, not a lot, but I see that they're often involved with self-exploration conferences, mm-hmm, or seminars. I think one of the places out east, Kripalu.
Okay.
Kripalu Institute. Anyway, they have big catalogs they send in the mail, and I think it's somewhere in the middle of New York State, but they get together, and it's primarily yoga, but I mean, there's also courses in other kinds of self-involvement and self-understanding, mm-hmm, and frequently memoir writing, mm-hmm, can provide that special insight, as well as being a very important, in a way, historical document, too, which might rank even above or maybe make better reading to those that come after you than a straight autobiography, which might just be maybe just too many facts, you know.
Yeah, just too many facts, too dense. Mm-hmm. Here there's imagery. There's sometimes I wove some poems in, for example, about the issues. Mm-hmm. And the language can, you know, be very creative. You know, mm-hmm, very.
And I see a copy of your book across the table here. It's not that long. It's not like 800 pages
no,
or something.
It isn't.
You know, that's great.
I
mean,
like
some people are a little afraid of those longer length things. That's, and as I said, an autobiography, you almost think, well, gee, 2 pages per year or something.
And does it have an index? That's the thing,
right,
for the autobiography.
Right.
So I can find whatever I want.
Well, that's important. Do you have an index?
No.
Okay.
Because it's there's if I could describe the cover,
sure,
there's a photograph of my mother is kind of in the flapper era, and then a smaller one of my grandmother, and then there's a glass, I guess a magnifying glass over my grandmother. And I should say, too, that my mother and grandmother were both named Nanny B, so I'm actually finding my mother as to her reality in this.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And then what did it do to me?
So, you know, it's a little like detective nonfiction, in fact, which I think is also a great stimulus, and makes the reading more exciting too, when the author is following a path of discovery. And in fact, that's a famous,
right,
of course, plot in great literature, the novel of self-understanding or self-education.
Great Expectations comes to mind.
Well, there's so many. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Although I'm sorry to say, in great literature, especially from, you know, the Western civilization, it's mainly young men discovering things and going on a path of discovery, mm-hmm, rather than women, unfortunately. So the story needs to be continued, but it needs to be told, I think, for everyone. But it would seem like, you know, when you're of a, as the French would say, a certain age, that you wonder how to leave behind some of those special thoughts and moments. And this memoir writing, and what's the word for the occupation? Memoirist?
Oh, I think memoirist or memoir.
Memoirist.
Word doesn't like that, though. It underlines it. So,
all right.
You know, so
person
I just,
that writes memoirs. All right. We got the idea on that.
Yeah.
So we've been talking with Dr. Nancy Owen Nelson, an adjunct professor of English here at Henry Ford College, full-time for many, many years, all kinds of literature that she's an expert on and has talked about, and taught creative writing, but right now her memoir is just being released, Searching for Nanny B, Three Generations of Southern Women, and it's going to be a special actual service, if you will, in the Unitarian Universalist style, this Sunday down at the First Unitarian Universalist Church in the Wayne State campus area at Cass and Forest. Big church, you can't miss it if you're at Cass and Forest there, and all very friendly people. And it'll be, of course, it's available for sale.
Absolutely.
At there. And her website, Nancy Owen Nelson, NELSON.com. More information about how you might want to get a copy for yourself. And do highly recommend that our listeners, especially if they're of a certain age, find out more about memoir writing.
Mm-hmm.
Just reading your example might be a great stimulus.
They can contact me via the webpage, too. And we can, and I have a blog and all of that. I can just send
my
them
goodness.
That. I know.
She's everywhere.
I'm trying.
Yeah. All of us have to be everywhere these days in order to stay in touch. So, thank you for being on the WHFR Journal today. Dr. Nancy Nelson, her new book, Searching for Nanny B, Three Generations of Southern Women. Good luck with that. And I'm excited to read it myself. So
well,
there you go.
Thank you, Jay. Thank you. And
okay.
John, thank you.
Yes.
I'm sorry. John, did you have a follow-up final question?
Yeah.
He always does, and I always cut him off. Go ahead.
Poor John.
The question is, when you began writing this book, Did you all of a sudden get help from family members coming out of the woodwork to tell you type of things?
Not so much, unless I ask them.
Oh, okay.
And there, you know, because I'm a young, a late baby, then everybody's pretty much gone.
Ah.
Except for this woman who's 92, and thank heavens I found her.
Oh, yeah.
And there's something about a two buttons in there that she had in her sewing box from my grandmother, and it's a huge part of the story, and there's a picture of the button, the actual button on the cover. Mm-hmm. So.
Sounds exciting.
Very, very
good. Oh, yeah.
Yep.
Well, thank you for that bit of creativity, and thank you for being part of Henry Ford College all these years and still here helping our program, and in many other ways you're getting your knowledge and your stimulus for others to do great writing, too. And I think that's what's the most important thing, is get the enthusiasm out there for other people to be as creative as they can be.
Everyone's story is important.
Absolutely. Again, thank you very much for coming by the Journal. We're going to have two comments now and then move on with local news and alternative views. First of all, don't forget about the one-act plays coming up. Let's see. We'll start with Jack Lessenberry's commentary about problem we have with absentee voting in Michigan. That's important, and we'll talk more about that. And then the one-act play promotion, which has already started here at Henry Ford College. And here it comes.
For years, Michigan has made it harder to cast a vote than most other states. Most states now have early voting, where you can show up at the polls and cast a vote on certain days before the election. Most states also allow anyone to request an absentee ballot who wants one, no questions asked. There are only 14 states that don't allow either option, and Michigan, along with Mississippi and Alabama, is one. Not only do we have no early voting, there are very specific rules for who can even request an absentee ballot. They include voters over 60, those needing assistance casting a vote, those working as election inspectors outside their home precinct, and, oh yes, those in jail awaiting arraignment. Somehow, I guess not many votes are cast by those behind bars. Everyone who doesn't fit into one of those categories has to stand in line on election day, which means that in our highly mobile and extremely busy world, many people end up not voting. Their kids get sick, they have some crisis at work, or they don't have the time to stand in line. Well, now a couple of Republican women are trying to do something about that. State Representative Lisa Postumus-Lyons has introduced a bill to allow anyone to get an absentee ballot as long as they're a registered voter. Perhaps more importantly, Secretary of State Ruth Johnson, the key Michigan official in charge of elections, is strongly supporting the bill. What happens next will be very interesting from a number of perspectives. First of all, this is an idea that's long overdue. It isn't fair to make a mother with three small children try to find time to stand in line to vote. And we need to make it possible for as many citizens as possible to not only vote, but cast an informed vote. Personally, I think we'd all be much better off if everyone cast an absentee ballot, as is now the case in Washington and Oregon. There's so many candidates and so many proposals on most ballots that no voter can possibly make informed decisions on all these contests in a voting booth. But what happens next will tell us something very interesting about the Republican Party. There are those who say most Republicans are not in favor of making it easier to vote. That, some of them fear, would lead to more Democrats voting. It's true that under the current system, Republican-leaning voters have historically been more likely to vote than Democrats. Michigan Republicans have also refused to consider early voting. However, now, the two main figures supporting what's called no-reason absentee voting are both Republican women. That doesn't guarantee anything, however. Last year, Secretary Johnson came out in favor of requiring more openness and transparency in campaign financing, and for requiring disclosure of the identities of those shadowy groups who give millions to so-called issue-oriented ads. Senate Majority Leader Arlen Meekhoff immediately rammed through a bill allowing them to continue to conceal their identities, and Governor Snyder signed it. If no reason absentee voting fails to pass, it will tell us everything we need to know about Michigan's legislative leadership's commitment to democracy.
Henry Ford College is holding its 30th annual One Act Play Festival from June 18th through June 28th at the McKenzie Fine Arts Center on the main campus. Due to some adult content, individuals must be 18 or older to attend. Performances are 8 p.m. on Thursdays through Saturdays and 2 p.m. on Sundays. All seats which are on stage in an intimate setting are $7. For further information and or to make reservations, call 313-845-9817 That's 313-845-9817. Tickets are also available online at www.theater.hfcc.edu. So come join tomorrow's superstars and enjoy an evening of theater June 18th through the 28th at the McKenzie Fine Arts Center on Henry Ford College's main campus. We'll see you there.
The one-act plays special every springtime here at the college. In fact, the 30th year, we had a great interview with Jerry Jablinski, who's the supervisor of the directors and organizer of this festival for all 30 years. And it started last night. Certainly by next week, John Conroy has promised to give us a capsule theater review because he's perhaps going to be able to be there tomorrow. I want to get over there, too, because it's four short plays written by really great professional authors, presented by, of course, the Henry Ford College Theater Group. And that's really well-qualified students. Remember the student we had on last week here?
Yep.
He's been in theater and won awards all the way through his high school years. And he's got like 9 years of experience, and he's only now in junior college. So Christian Planka. Right. Christian Planka was his name. And the playwrights, if you know who these people are, Edward Albee, Tennessee Williams, A.R. Gurney, and Peter Appleton. And I highly recommend all the plays, and I think the experience is going to be really intense. It is recommended for 18 and above, because there's some serious adult stuff going on there. I know kids these days can probably handle anything, but without being upset. But let's not push it, huh? One Act Play Festival, Thursday, Friday, Saturday at 8 p.m. at the Adre Auditorium here and the Fine Arts Center at Henry Ford College, main campus, and Sundays at 2 p.m. So what a great thing to do with Father. Bring him on over here this Sunday for Father's Day at the One Act Festival starting at 2 p.m. All tickets are just $7 a person, and it's going to be a sort of intimate seating in the three-quarter round, and it's going to be a great experience. So I'm going to try to sneak in sometime next week. That's my plan. Got a little busy this week, unfortunately, but it's very exciting. The One Act Play Festival, Henry Ford College, main campus, Fine Arts Center. I wanted to mention, because as I sometimes do, at least briefly, you know, I'll try not to take up too much time, about the holidays. Okay. Because I think we should remember how they got started. Now, of course, the idea can change, and you can celebrate them any way you want to, of course. But Father's Day. The first thing I have to say, and this is also because Nancy Nelson was here from the English department, from my English department days, how do you think Father's Day is spelled? Is Father's spelled with an apostrophe somewhere?
I would think it would be.
Yeah, well, because the day is possessed by the Father. In other words, it's the day of the Father. It's interesting that the appropriate way to honor all fathers is to spell it F-A-T-H-E-R-S apostrophe. That's the plural possessive. Okay, but guess what? It got approved and adopted a couple of times informally, but then finally, and this is relatively late, it was made a permanent national holiday under President Richard Nixon, signed it into law in 1972. So it'd been around from the turn of the 1800s to the 1900s, the beginning of the 20th century, in some places, and it was relatively informal, but they finally made it a permanent formal holiday, but they spelled it apostrophe S, which is grammatically incorrect unless you're only talking about one father.
Yeah, right.
The Father Day. Who is the Father? Unless you're talking about religious terms, the Father up above, no, it's not religious in that sense. It never was connected to a religion. In fact, it has been rejected over the years, especially in the 1930s. A couple people were trying to get it organized, women, interestingly, for there to be a Father's Day. And eventually this one person, her name was... Sarona Smart Dodd, She got the help of a group in 1938 called the Father's Day Council, founded by New York Associated Menswear Retailers, to consolidate and systematize the commercial promotion. But Americans in general, says Wikipedia, resisted the holiday for the first few decades. So 20, 30 years, it wasn't a big thing. It might have been, and it was informal still. Remember, it hadn't been made an actual holiday, in this country. Mm-hmm. And in fact, most countries of the world, it's a holiday, but it's not an official national holiday. So we're kind of special that we did that. And of course, the reason they rejected it, the public knew that it was nothing more than an attempt by merchants to replicate the commercial success of Mother's Day. And even newspapers frequently featured cynical and sarcastic attacks and jokes about Father's Day. So that wasn't helping at all. They did have a bill to accord national recognition way back in 1913, but apparently didn't pass. President Woodrow Wilson wanted to adopt it, but that didn't happen. President Calvin Coolidge recommended the day be observed by the nation, but stopped short of issuing a proclamation. Two other attempts to recognize it had also been defeated by the Congress. But then in 1957, Maine Senator Margaret Chase Smith, again, a woman, kind of interesting that there's all the women asking for a Father's Day. Right. So, thank you, women. As a father myself, thank you. Well, she wrote a proposal accusing Congress of ignoring fathers for 40 years while honoring mothers. She says, thus singling out just one of our two parents. And then Lyndon Johnson in 1966, when he was president, he issued the first presidential proclamation honoring fathers, saying it should be on the third Sunday in June. But it wasn't a permanent holiday until Richard Nixon signed it into law in 1972. By the way, what about those husbands and those men and boys who don't have a day? Well, in many places of the world, I don't think here, I've never heard of it, there is an International Men's Day. Because, after all, you know, we do have, isn't it, well, it's Women's History Month in February, right? Or is it March? Well, okay, there's a Women's History
Month.
Yes, I know there. Yep. And I think there is one day that's a Woman's Day, and other than Mother's Day. We can look that up. We'll stumble upon that. But the point here is that there is many, many failed attempts at establishing a Father's Day, and yet now it is recognized as, in terms of gifts for men, it's the second best thing to Christmas. So that's primarily why it was, but that's how it helped get it established when the business, the profit motive happened to come into it. Then you had support from not just a few women, but also, it's interesting there's no man or father that asks that they be recognized.
No.
And I hate to say it, I've never felt that I should be honored on Father's Day. You know, why? I'm a father. Okay, I'm very proud of my daughter. And but I think becoming a father is pretty easy. whereas becoming a mother is not so easy for a woman, especially at the childbirth moment. But also, in traditional terms, in the past, the father was primarily not the one raising the child. The father was earning the money, and the woman, the wife, would be at home raising the children. So she had the majority of the influence over the early education of the children. So the father was there, had to be there, helping, and maybe significant moments, you know, before he left for work or when he came back, or maybe weekends if he didn't have to work. But not the same emphasis at all as the job of a woman. And today, the job of a woman as mother is even more difficult, of course, because they usually have to have a job themselves. Not just because they might be a single mother, but because the family needs a little more income. So you have to balance all of the responsibilities there. And maybe now today, because of the economic necessity for several incomes, the father and the mother really should be celebrated equally if they're all contributing a little bit of everything all the time. You know, it's just my thought on it. But it is one of the most bogus of holidays. The only one that's more recent, which is also shamelessly commercial, I believe, is Sweetest Day.
Sweetest day.
Yeah, and that was developed by an advertising agency. Evil. For the purpose of selling. Because don't you already have Valentine's Day? Well, see, that was just like just young people. Now, Sweetest Day, you can get sweet with anybody at any time, I guess. So it's a wider audience that maybe wasn't covered by, you know, Valentine's Day, I guess. So anyway, that's Father's Day. So do what you like, but certainly if you have a father who made a significant difference in your life, got you to where you are today.
And some businesses.
They deserve to be recognized, although I think it should be one of those all year long things. You know. Yes. And businesses, John?
Well, I was just saying some businesses do allow fathers to have maternity leave on when their child is born.
Yes. So yes. I just heard something on public radio news this morning about that, there are a lot of changes happening. And although America has the least amount of maternity leave, whether for women or men, but a lot of men are getting maternity leave now, too. And they said in the United States, it's primarily the Silicon Valley companies, the computer companies, are very good at giving as much as a year off to the man to help raise the kids. And that's great. Again, especially if you have a two-income family, the woman can't be there all the time. So somebody has to. So.
And the key is keeping that man there so that the men do their job as fathers.
Well, more than just of course, there's a lot of single parent families. And unfortunately, in most cases, it's the woman who is still there, mm-hmm. not the man. And that we hope somehow that can change because what's the, was it an early book by Hillary Clinton? It Takes a Village.
Yes.
Implying it takes a village to raise a child. Mm-hmm. Well, it takes more than one person, certainly, to do a really good job. It mm-hmm. takes the father, plus the extended family, and the whole community, I think, needs to do things and help support raising the kids. The educational system, of course, primarily, you know, a lot of good teachers, a lot of good programs, and keep that creativity flowing all the time. Well, all right, moving on. We actually have some stories to talk about. This week, and it's somewhat connected with religion, but each year there is, I think it's a full month, pretty close to a month. Ramadan has already begun here in Dearborn. State Representative George T. Durrani has passed his, annual resolution to offer best wishes to Muslims in Michigan and worldwide on the joyous and meaningful observance of Ramadan. During this time, Muslims engage in reflection, fasting, and prayer. His direct quote is, "For so many of our Muslim friends and neighbors in Dearborn access and across the state, Ramadan is a profound time of fasting, family sacrifice, prayer, and charity. As members of our community embark on their month-long journey of spirituality and discipline, we are reminded of the importance of reflection and faith. I extend my warmest wishes to our community members while they engage in the great tradition of Ramadan." And of course, you know the background here, which is in Durrani's press release, too. It's the month that the Muslim holy book, the Quran, was revealed to Prophet Muhammad. The holy month of Ramadan is the ninth month of the Islamic calendar, which is not the same as the calendar we typically use, which is the Gregorian calendar, I believe we call it. And so it's different every year. It usually keeps coming earlier each time, each year as we go along. So I assume that the Islamic calendar month or months, or all, its full year, is a shorter period of days. What do I know?
But, don't know.
Yeah. And it began at sunrise on June 18th this week. That was yesterday. And it ends on July 17th. So it is pretty much 30 full days. Muslims are encouraged to refrain from eating and drinking, among other activities, during the daylight hours. They typically end their fast at sunset with meals and prayer. That's when they really say, "Yalla, eat." Yeah, let's go eat. The evening is also a time to spend with family as a tradition. And, of course, the resolution was adopted by the Michigan House of Representatives unanimously. See, our legislature can get together on something.
They care.
They can really move these bills along, even though Ramadan comes every year. They can really agree that it's happening. And, you know, all those things are good things. Except if you fast too much, you're not so fast anymore. You're very slow because you're hungry. But so it is. It's a little bit of a health problem, and there is exceptions here, of course, for people who need sustenance throughout the day in that religion, of course. Just like there were exceptions for Lent in the Catholic religion and dietary exemptions that were acceptable. Being with family, always a good thing. Sacrifice, and of course, Lent is a time to give up something, one thing, usually pick something. Prayer, okay, and if it works for you. And charity, of course. Charity sounds great to me. So it's, and boy, it's really something. It's really a discipline that's challenging when you have to do it for 30 days.
That would definitely be difficult. Yep.
Yeah. But, of course, there'd be community reinforcement in with that to help you, and family reinforcement, too. So, okay, well, then good luck. And and we can move on. All right. Let's see. Taylor, there was a story in last Sunday's Press and Guide about their music and art in the garden. Concerts began already. John, you were at one last week?
Yes. Big Ray and the Motor City Kings played last Wednesday. Very fine performance and very well attended. They're performing every Wednesday. Not that group, but they have different groups that perform from 5:30 to about 8:30 each Wednesday night.
And the location is?
Is at the Taylor Conservatory, which is at North Line and Pardee, right at the entrance.
Okay.
As you see the big tower.
Is there a small fee or is it free?
It's $5.
$5, very reasonable. And some really, I noticed a few of the names that were connected with both blues and jazz a little bit that were coming up. So is that the tenor of most of it, or is there a wider variety than that?
Actually wider. There was a Latin group there that played this past Wednesday.
Oh, okay. Mm-hmm.
And there's different themes almost every week.
And it's outdoors, so weather permitting.
Weather permitting.
I guess, okay.
Well, and there is a new pavilion there now, so that if there is weather problems, they can go inside.
Yeah, they had a photograph in Press and Guide. It looked like a very, very pretty location for that. And, of course, there's still... There's concerts now, once every two Fridays at the Bryant Library in their outside little park area, and at the old City Hall Park, as I call it, since City Hall is not there in Dearborn anymore. That's going to be weekly, but it won't begin until, I think, July. We'll talk about that, too. So a lot of nice things to do to get out. I'm hoping it won't be raining every single day for a while. That gets really frustrating. There's a story in the news that the farmers in Windsor, just right across the river here, okay, they can't plant for this year. It's the first year that there's so much water still laying in the fields. It hasn't dried up or run off or anything that they can't go and plant whatever they plant, seeds for corn or whatever. So they're going to be weeks behind planting time. They said they've never been this far into June and still can't plant.
Not having no plant.
That's how much rain we've had and how constant the rain has been. I mean, almost every day. Some rain, so it never can really totally get dry, which is okay for your grass, perhaps, but still. So this is extreme weather time, folks, and luckily we haven't had any great tragedies. A couple flooded streets in this area, but that's been about it. All right, moving on then. The Dearborn Times-Herald for this week, they mentioned the name, and I'm not going to over-advertise it, because I think he should just be allowed to do it. But there's a pastor from Tempe, Arizona, who a Christian, a Baptist, in fact, who wants to come to Dearborn and distribute a DVD. He's got 1,000 copies of a DVD that he had dubbed into Arabic that he wants to give to Arabs. And I don't know anything more about that. The story didn't say exactly what the DVD was. I assume they're talking about maybe conversion or something that people... should be trying to expand their mind about what Christianity is, perhaps, and as an alternative. I don't know, but he's not here. In fact, the word was march to Dearborn. I don't think he's marching to Dearborn from Arizona. And then the word marathon came up. he's not going to run to Dearborn from Arizona. I don't think that he looks like a young guy, but I don't think he's going to himself run what would be 2,000 miles. I don't think so. So if he wants to go door to door and wants to offer people a free DVD, they can either accept it or not. I don't see that the city should get the police out or whatever. It doesn't seem like he's going to hold a rally like a certain other minister from Florida did for a couple of years, mm-hmm. Where we had more police attend than we had residents. It was pretty crazy.
But it sounds to me as that it may be more of a introduction rather than conversion attempt.
If you don't want to open the door, you don't have to, folks. Right. I'm just trying to minimize the controversy about it, but mm-hmm. it's good to know maybe that that's going to happen, I guess. But I don't think it's a cause for concern.
No.
Dearborn Library, this is very good, and it's only in the Times Herald this week. See why I said you should always subscribe to both Dearborn papers?
Press and Guide and
the Times Herald. Because this is the story. Dearborn Public Library has launched an app. That's an application for a computer that allows library card holders, and I've got to get one. I had one, but I think I lost it. I don't think I'm still in the system, to access and stream more than 300,000 movies, music, comics, and ebooks for free mm-hmm. without going to the library, right from your computer at home. Wow. Now, I know that they've had ebooks somehow available, but this sort of streaming thing, with that many movies and all kinds of music and even comic books, the system that they've affiliated with is called Hoopla Digital. And it says you can stream it to smartphones, tablets, PCs, and Apple TV. And of course, I've got a Fire TV accessory between my internet connection and my TV because I don't have cable now. Cable gives me the internet, but I don't have any programming from cable. I gave that up a few months ago. So maybe it works with Fire TV from Kindle, also from Amazon. And let's see what it takes. Continue on page 8A. Okay. You're going to ask, is there a cost? Do I have to buy an extra box? Well, you don't have to buy any extra equipment, apparently, if you already have an internet coming into your house and either a computer or maybe there's a way to connect it to your TV set through one of these other boxes you might already have. By the way, they've already had a launch of the idea. It began in May to teach the staff and work out any issues. And the app formally launched earlier this month for all library card holders. So there's a reason to get a library card. Content on it from major Hollywood studios, publishers, and record companies such as Walt Disney Pictures. Users can check out up to 10 movies, songs, or albums, comics, and ebooks each month. Each item has its own limit for how long it can be checked out to a user. Patrons can renew an item as many times as they'd like, but each renewal will count as a checkout. So you're limited to 10 checkouts per month, but that's two or three a week, so that would seem to be doable.
Now, are library card holders strictly the Dearborn card holders for Centennial Library and Bryant Library?
The article doesn't say here, and I hope to have someone when we're out live. We'll mention in a minute. We'll be right next to the Bryant Public Library. Hope to have someone from the library system talk about this on the air with us next week, Friday, at the Dearborn Farmers and Artists Market. We're going to be doing some interviews and meeting the public, maybe you, if you want to come by. We'll be there from 9 o'clock on, but doing our interviews with some people we've already set up between 10 o'clock and 1, and then if we have a voice left, from 1 to 2 o'clock, we'll be doing the journal live from out there, too. And we have George T. Duraney himself, our local representative, whose name I just mentioned earlier. And he's going to be our main guest during that hour. Now, that's, of course, weather permitting and technology permitting. We're still testing our equipment to see what works there. Apparently there's no late fees because Hoopla has an automatic return feature. In other words, you sign up, it's completely online, so you just can't stream it. You can't watch it anymore after it expires. It's so when they say you're returning it, you're not returning it as such. It's just expiring. Okay, it does automatically expire. Maybe you can return them and get another choice quicker if you technically, but it's not returning anything physical. Do you follow, folks? Okay. So library cardholders can access the service online at hoopladigital.com or by downloading the app and signing up with their email, library card number, and personal identification number. So we'll find out more, but that's really a great service, the library facilities coming to you for free. And to answer your question, John, years ago, people outside of Dearborn could get a library card, but they have to pay money. That was something pretty reasonable, but years ago, I think it was like $25 a year. Okay. So now it might be more if they allow that. And whether or not you would get Hoopla Digital,
right,
you know, or just borrowing the books. I was just part of a survey. I'm not sure how they found me, but a survey that came to me by email from the Dearborn Library. They wanted to find out, you know, how many books do I check out? How much do I use the library? And it was sad to say that I don't use the library that much anymore. Okay, not at all. And I'm one of those very bad people. I know we have some listeners who are having a fit right now. How could a college-educated person not use the library? It's because they found other sources, you know, online and so on. And I read a lot of books, but I actually buy a lot of books. I have a thing about buying books. I like to give them away for free, for presents at different times of year to other people. I like the hard copy because I think that will circulate for many, many more years than electronic copy, which can go poof at any time.
Right.
You know. Plus, if you hold on to a book, the library, if I found a great book at the library and I read it, and then I have to give it back?
Hmm.
Ouch. Of course, I could just go and then buy it once I found it. But I have ways of browsing books online, reading a good portion of them, and then if I like them, I buy them. And I always buy the hard copy. So I'm a big supporter of books, but there are certain services that I put, and it's too long for me to go into it now, that I put in the survey that I would like to see the library do and would be more helpful. Also, I think it's great for kids and families, and they need to expand and maintain their children's section of the library, especially for browsing for the kids. I think the kids should just be able to go there and sit comfortably and read and browse and pick a lot of books and put them back. And sure, they could check some out, but I just think it should be a great facility for children to explore all the joys of reading and books, maybe with their parents' supervision. Let's move on.
I just wanted to add one thing about the services at a library now, where you can get, if you have a library card, you can get access to the DIA, et cetera, other art type of places, just for having a library pass at whatever library you belong to.
That may be true.
There's a whole slew of different places that you can get access to.
Okay. Well, I know that if you buy a membership in a major like museum, like the DIA, we still have the Science Museum in downtown Detroit, don't we? That qualifies you, maybe at a certain level of donation anyway, qualifies you to get free admission to a lot of major musicians around the whole country, museums around the whole country.
Right.
If you travel a lot, that might be valuable. Absolutely. Whatever. Free is such a good price. People ought to do it. Yeah. And I would recommend especially the magazine selections. It's really hard to find a good magazine selection, even in a bookstore like Barnes & Noble anymore. They carry maybe 100, 200 titles. Would you believe there's 10,000 magazines that are published on a regular basis in the United States? Mm-hmm. Well, how do you find out about them? Maybe you'd love them. Maybe you'd love to read them regularly. Maybe you'd want to subscribe. How do you find out? It's even hard to find out online, folks. But libraries typically subscribe to an awful lot more than what you find at any bookstore like Barnes & Noble. Mm. So get to your local library and check it out. Maybe something fun to do, something really different maybe. Raise the Wolf campaign got a nice story covering it from Sue Suchita in the Dearborn Times Herald this week too. That is the official title of the money to build the new animal shelter for the Friends of the Dearborn Animal Shelter group. And so that they did have a breakfast and this last Wednesday at the center to make their case. That was too early for me, but it gives a lot of details here, and we hope to have someone from very soon have someone again, because we have many times we've had visits from the Friends for the Dearborn Animal Shelter explained their needs and purposes. But now it's official. Now they need people to sign up. They still need $5.7 million, but any contribution is tax deductible. They're an official nonprofit organization. And the city of Dearborn is donating $400,000 for the land, $400,000 for campaign costs. They have to raise $400,000 for pledge defaults. Oh, pledge defaults! Ouch! And a $500,000 endowment. That's all included in the $5.7 million project. Right. In fact, oh my goodness, 6 minutes to go. Highway 61 with Joanne Kraczynska is coming up at 2 o'clock or so, and John Conroy has left the studio, and he will be with us next week out at the Dearborn Farmers and Artists Market with me. So come on down to see us. I'm just going to do a couple more stories here to round up the hour before Highway 61 Blues gets started. Interestingly, in the Dearborn Times-Herald, they got a guest editorial from one of their sister newspapers. Their whole point is the road plan in Michigan to fix the road. It's the plan that the Detroit News, a number of bills, but the plan the Detroit News already said is completely untenable and crazy and won't raise enough money and is not supportable, sustainable in the future even. But that's what they're voting on right now in the legislature. So that's our number one question for George Doreney. What's happening with the roads and why can't we get a system that is going to work? And the point of the guest editorial in the Dearborn Times Herald is that the road plan is a tax hike on working families, even those that don't use the roads, perhaps. And that's not the way it should be. Okay. Why can't conservatives understand that if they raise the gasoline tax, it's a user tax? The people that use the roads the most with gasoline-powered cars are going to be paying more. And what about those people buying hybrids or electric cars? And God bless them for doing that. Well, the answer is they'll have to pay more in registration fees when they get their, you know, license plates each year, their registration. That's the only way you can cover that. And that's a small answer. Why can't they be done? That could have been done years ago. Well, the Republicans said no new taxes. And I do want to mention to you the editorial by Jack Lesenberry in the Metro Times this week, which clearly points out how crazy all that is. Let's see here. I'll just read a few minutes of it because we've got a couple minutes. Let's end with his very strong opinions, and he's getting clearly very hot under the collar. And so stop wearing collars, Jack. And this is what he has to say. Well, it's now clear what kind of future the Republicans who run the state legislature have in mind for us. The roads will continue to fall apart, though we will throw a little money at them by raising taxes on the working poor. There won't be any nasty film industry. They are moving now to not only kill the last of the film tax credit, but to eliminate the Michigan Film Office itself, which has been around since 1979. But they do have a plan for economic growth. Michigan is to become the nation's privatized penal colony. I'm not kidding, he says. And by the way, except for the roads, our supposedly moderate governor seems happily down with their agenda. Last month, the legislature narrowly passed a bill that would allow the GEO Group, a multinational so-called correctional services provider, to import hundreds of the most dangerous criminals from Vermont and Washington State and guard them at now privately run prison in Baldwin, up in mostly rural northwest Michigan. Baldwin is in Lake County, which 24/7 Wall Street ranks as the poorest county in the state. Governor Rick Snyder dithered for a couple of weeks and then signed it. Politicians up there like the idea just fine, mainly for one reason. We need jobs, Lake County Commissioner Dan Sloan said. Nobody doubts that. Michigan needs jobs, period. But at what cost, asks Jack Lessenberry, allowing for a for-profit private company, and a foreign one at that, to do what amounts to trafficking in human flesh. State Senator Steve Bida, an attorney and huge history buff, is one of the most more conscientious men in Lansing. He's well-informed on criminal justice issues and is not anybody you'd call soft on crime, but he's been working hard to get his colleagues to do the right thing and pass a bill to commensurate those who are exonerated after being wrongly convicted and locked up in some cases. Bida, a 51-year-old Democrat from Warren, is well aware that Michigan needs new law, new revenue, but he thinks this is appalling in every way. He told his colleagues it was disgraceful that, quote, when the legislature is looking to treat prisoners like a commodity and import people, yes, even when incarcerated, there are still people, to create jobs and make money. Sort of sounds like slavery, doesn't it? Says Jack Lessenberry. What do you think about that? Read the full statement in this week's Detroit Metro Times, which is free at one place or the other. Remember, all opinions on the new WHFR Journal that have been expressed today by anyone, including Jack Lessenberry, are not necessarily those of Henry Ford College staff, faculty, students. And wrapping up some other things going on here in the news, want to commend also in the Dearborn Press and Guide, the Rotary of Dearborn Heights has launched its first Little Free Library. And that's where you can bring a book, take a book. That's right, you can possess the books. I think I suggested that for the Dearborn Library, too. Bring a book, take a book. There's no checkout involved. Just the honor system, as they say. This goes on many places in the country, okay? And it's worked, but there's a history of it. That's why it worked. Goodwill in various parts of the country, Goodwill type stores, Salvation Army stores, sometimes, I know in Arizona, have a whole wall of cubicles, and you can put clothing in there, toys, whatever, leave something, take something. And that's the system, and it works. No cost. Talk about recycling, huh? So this is kind of like that, but not with the clothes any or the toys. It's the first Little Free Library, and they did it Thursday in the garden in front of the Vet Select Animal Hospital in Dearborn Heights. Mayor Daniel Poletko ushered in the event and with the ceremonious cutting of the red ribbon. So good luck to that. I hope it's not just going to be outside of the Vet Select Animal Hospital, but also inside. We'll see how that goes. We'll follow it. But give one, take one. It's a great idea. Okay? So it's WHFR Dearborn you're listening to. Our podcast will cut off in a minute or so, but I'm just going to cover a few more stories. Okay.
The last...
Hi, John is back. Yes.
The last buffet.
Yes. Oh, absolutely. The last international buffet is coming up this coming Thursday from 11 to 1 o'clock, and that's in the 5101 restaurant here at Henry Ford College. And you might want to get a reservation for the last buffet this summer semester until fall, sometime later in the fall. That'll open again, of course, but usually a big turnout. So the number is 313-206-5101, because that's the name of the restaurant here in our student center at the front of the campus, as they say, right next to Evergreen Road in Dearborn. A lot of free parking around here. Come on down. Usually the price is $14. I'm not sure if this is a special final finale, but it's about $14 a person. And considering the quality and variety of the food, this time the International Buffet is going to have sort of the best of, not leftovers, but from all the countries of the world, they're picking dishes, so there'll be a wide representation.